Well, hello again, TGP. It's Monday, March the 7th, 2022. This is In the Know, episode 33. Did you think I went away? Nope, that's just a pregnant pause. And now it got weird. You know what? I'm going to leave that in. I'm not even going to go back and change that. Sorry about that. Okay, let's do a few announcements as we get started on this week's newsletter podcast. First of all, March the 20th, 2022 is going to be a big day. We will have regular Sunday service. We will have a family meeting immediately after the morning service to replace the elder selection section, the appendix, on how to select elders of the guiding document. So we're going to hopefully, Lord willing, pull that out and replace it so that we can do this in a more streamlined fashion. And then when that's in place, our plan is to nominate at least one new elder, perhaps more than one, and enter into a month-long time of prayer and fasting where the elders will vet and verify the desire of the men, and then we'll present them for affirmation in April. And then that night, March 20th, we will have a Sunday evening service at 5 p.m. Then March the 25th, that next Friday, is our first of a series of outreach events this year that we're just going to call Free Pizza Friday. We're putting a lot of our old Sportsville budget into just buying pizza, a bunch of pizza, and hoping that people will show up and let us feed them, and then we will do a short gospel presentation. But this is going to be open to everybody, anybody who wants to come, college kids or Wardville folks or our church family, whoever. It's a big time to just meet folks, feed them, and hopefully speak gospel words to them. Okay, so that's going to happen March 25th, and there will be more announcements to follow. Then April 1st and 2nd will be the IF Women's Gathering. If you need more information, contact Allison Hinsgens. And then finally, April 24th, we are calling a family meeting to affirm new elders. Lord willing, we will do that then. Okay, let's jump into a little bit of sermon recap. And not so much recap. Well, one of these will be more like recap, but one is essentially going to be something new. Let's talk about Jacob and the Exodus. This is the new thing. This story, the one that we're currently reading, in many ways is a foreshadowing of Israel's exodus from Egypt. Now, as with every foreshadowing, there are hints. It's not like it's a detail for detail, one-to-one scenario, but there are things that remind you, that call that to mind. There are events and there are things that happen and words that are said that remind you of the other thing. Okay, so don't forget that the original audience of the book of Genesis was post-Exodus Israel in the wilderness. This is the first of what we call the five books of Moses, or sometimes we just call it the fivefold book, the Pentateuch. And it's recorded and written by Moses so that they, the Israelites, could have this official record of the events that led up to that and that happened after in the wilderness and the recording of the law. So it should be no surprise then that we find these Exodus themes throughout the book. Like Jacob will literally become Israel in a matter of a few chapters of our study. Now that's not the only similarity though. Jacob, just consider this, Jacob has been doing hard labor in a foreign country. There's similarity number one. He is taken advantage of by a self-interested taskmaster intent on keeping him there for his own profit. Similarity two. only by mighty acts of God's mercy toward his people and justice on their enemies does he bring out his people from that foreign land. And God brings out his people, having enriched them with the wealth of those who sought their harm. So there's similarity four. And they return from that foreign land into Canaan, like the promised land, both times, more numerous and prosperous than when they originally set out. The people of Israel in the wilderness at that time would have identified deeply with this story, with this account, and it would have encouraged them to see God bring their forefathers into the land. Like, it would have encouraged them and challenged them that they must see God's mighty hand at work and trust his good intention to bring them into their homeland. And the call is actually similar for us, the people of God. We live as exiles in a foreign land. Like, we know this world is not home, and we have many adversaries who seek our harm. But God has promised that he will bring us home. And so with this promise of home in our hearts, we likewise, with the eyes of faith, must choose to see his mighty hand at work and trust his good intention to do for us all that he has promised to do. So as it encouraged the people of God then in the wilderness, Israel, so now it also can encourage the people of God, the church, in many of the same ways. Let's talk for a second a little bit deeper about our silly superstitions. I hope you are able to identify ways you believe or even hold to or adhere to silly superstitions in your own lives. Our lives do not operate on the basis of grace plus anything, but by grace alone, through faith alone. We do not add to the gospel either through our works or by our superstitions. And what are superstitions but exactly that? We believe that there are forces other than God at work that can be manipulated or otherwise need to be appeased in order to get what we want. Or, I might add to that, maybe we think that God needs us to do certain things to appease him so that we get what we want. So we recite the correct incantation, or eat the mandrakes, or peel the rods, or read the horoscopes to determine the right time for something, or knock on wood, or flip a coin, or throw salt over our shoulders, or refuse to say bad things out of fear that they'll come true, or refuse to walk under a ladder, or other silly things like that. So sometimes we do those silly things that are just plain silly, and we put too much stock in them. At other times, our superstitions, and I'm leaning now on a man named Scott Redd at the Gospel Coalition. He wrote an article called "Don't Be a Superstitious Christian." So other times, he points out, our superstitions may be good things that we give too much credit to for favorable circumstances. So like, we believe that somehow our church attendance or regular giving protects our family from harm, or that like missing a quiet time in the morning means that everything bad that happens that day stems from some sort of karma-like retributive justice arising from God's displeasure over our failure to read the Bible. Like, our world does not operate that way. More importantly, God does not operate that way with his children. There is an attractiveness to these things, these superstitions, because we want to be in control. We want to believe that there's an easier way to get what we want rather than doing the harder thing of going to God, asking him, and waiting on him without knowing whether or not we will actually get what we want. When we try to seize control of our circumstances or manipulate particular outcomes, what we're really doing is not only circumventing and failing to believe God's sovereignty and circumventing this process of seeking him and waiting on him, but we're actually trying to be God. We are being little sovereigns, both in defining what is best for us, the desired outcome, and in trying to order our lives and work our circumstances so that we achieve that outcome. So, because we don't want God to withhold the thing that we think we need. So we're playing God in that we're saying, I need this outcome. And then we try to manipulate our environment or other people or God to get that thing that we want. And we're trying to be in control both in deciding what's best for us and in getting that thing that we've defined as best for us. Like, that is trying to be God. As His redeemed creatures, though, our portion is simply to trust Him, His wisdom, His goodness, His sovereignty, His justice, and His grace. We keep on entrusting ourselves to Him who judges justly. 1 Peter 2:23. Superstitions are not a supplement to faith. They are opposed to it. I would argue that Jacob's actions constituted the opposite of faith, of acting in faith, even if he would say something like, well, I'm just trying to do something rather than nothing. Like, sometimes faith requires action, and sometimes faith requires waiting, especially if the alternative is some sort of sinful attempt to help God out, or worse, an attempt to be God. It will always require wisdom to know when action is necessary and when it is not, but we must do what faith requires of us in all circumstances. In Jacob's case, I would argue that faith would have required him to run to God with this circumstance, call upon the promises he made in Bethel, that God made to him in Bethel, and then ask him to work on his behalf in accordance with those promises, and then wait on him in faith. Like, yes, continue to do the things that you've been doing the last 14 years. Continue working in Laban's flock and trust God to do whatever God's going to do and not start peeling those poplar rods. So I want to close by considering how we should read with moral clarity, but also with grace. Like, having written and now read all of that above, all of everything that's come before, I feel like sometimes we look at Old Testament figures and some New Testament ones, I'm looking at you, Peter, with some kind of disdain or perhaps maybe a sense of moral superiority. To be sure, we bring the proper amount of moral clarity, having been trained by the whole counsel of God with the Spirit indwelt eyes of faith and with thousands of years of church history and interpretation. However, that very moral clarity, a good thing that we have, is sometimes what can bring about that sense of moral superiority, a bad thing. We can so easily forget that what is a no-brainer to us was not necessarily a no-brainer to those living out those events. Things like having two wives, eating mandrakes, peeling poplar rods, for instance. Maybe it should have been, or maybe not. But what we need to bear in mind is that they, especially Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, did not at that time possess the full counsel of God. They didn't even have the law. They didn't even have Genesis. They were living it out. They didn't have the full counsel of God, the Spirit indwelt eyes of faith, right? Like, they didn't have the same experience of the Holy Spirit that a new covenant believer has, whereby He indwells us and never leaves, never departs from us. And so their faith was in some ways different in their experience of it, and in the way the Spirit works through it than ours is. So they didn't have the full counsel of God, the Spirit indwelt eyes of faith, nor did they have thousands of years of church history post-resurrection of Christ and then reflection thereupon that we do. Like, the standard for us in some ways ought to be higher, right? With greater knowledge and more revelation comes a heightened accountability and responsibility. But we need to season our reading of Genesis and the Old Testament and the New Testament with a measure of grace, while not abandoning our moral clarity. Like, it's okay to call something wrong, like I did. Like, I think, I'm pretty sure the peeling of the poplar rods was the opposite of faith. Eating the mandrakes was a superstition. Having two wives, not a good thing. Right? Like, I think it's okay to call something wrong, but it's not okay for us to act like if we swapped places with them, we'd fare better than they did. So let's read with charity and clarity, granting the same grace that God gave to them and that we would wish to receive were we in their shoes. So let's read the Bible and let's live life with both a sense of clarity and charity. Have a great week. I love you, people.